After what seems like ages, our guest this hour says we're now entering a new era, one marked by the decline of men and the rise of women. In fields like education, the workforce, and family dynamics, women are taking the lead while men are failing to adapt and receding onto the cultural sidelines. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, are we witnessing the twilight of male dominance? Our guest is Hannah Rosen. She's a contributing editor at The Atlantic and co-editor of Double X. Her latest book is called The End of Men and the Rise of Women. And we're looking forward to hearing from you. What do you think about a new world where women take the lead and men sit on the bench? Why are men having trouble adapting? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also find us on Facebook at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Hannah Rosen, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, can you give me a sense of what you're looking at globally when you talk about the rise of women and the decline or the end of men?
So let's start in the United States, where women are just having an easier time adapting to this new economy, which largely means that they're getting the education and credentials they need. Right now, for better or worse, what you need to get ahead in this economy is a college degree, and women are just better these days at getting college degrees. It's not that they're smarter. They just, for every 3 degrees that women earn, men earn only 2, and that's been going on for quite a while. So you see that starting to change, as you said in the beginning, our family dynamics, the decisions that people are making about who they marry, the decisions young people are making about their lives, how to raise their children, how we want our schools to look, the difference between boys and girls. So that was my big surprise in the book. I started this as an economic argument, and then I realized just how deeply it had seeped into our society.
And that's the United States mostly we're looking at first. What about globally? Is it true there?
Globally, you see this phenomenon happening filtered through different cultures. So we know one of my chapters in the book is about Korea. And Korea is a very interesting example because it's a powerfully patriarchal society and has always been set up that way. And yet the rise of women has happened so quickly that you see it just like you see the clash in society. You see that, you know, people are getting married at later and later ages, largely because the women have a certain expectation and ambition about their lives. And yet when they're married, they're expected to be a traditional wife. And so there's a real clash happening in Korea and Japan. Then you see different things in different parts of the world. The educational statistics are true all over the world. So even in the Middle East, you see women are starting to get more degrees than men are getting. But there, obviously, there's different expectations in society. But everywhere you go, you see certain kinds of pressures happening.
So when you look at the areas in the United States where men have been hit really hard in the job market, high finance and manufacturing, what's happened to those men since? What roles are they playing now that they're not sort of holding the reins?
Well, this is a tough story because right now men in America have the lowest labor force participation rate they've had since 1948. The Labor Department numbers just came out. So a lot of men out of work is not a great situation. I had many top economists tell me that this was one of our biggest social crises. And I think you can imagine what they mean. What they mean is that fewer men sort of taking – when men are out of work, that's a painful reality. It means that they're generally less connected to their families. What I see in a lot of families that I profile is that the women are basically doing a lot more. So they are raising the children. They're going to school. They're the ones working. Increasingly, they're the breadwinners in the family. And a lot of Americans are not getting married at all, as we know. And so it's not all good. I mean, this isn't sort of feminist triumphalism. Yay, we won. It's not really that kind of situation. There's lots of great opportunity for women here, but there's also a lot of heartbreak that I describe in the book.
Right. That's what's so hard about your book. I mean, I consider myself a feminist, and yeah, I might have thought that I would have been deliriously happy to hear that, but it's not a feel-good story at all. I mean, you can't really expect a whole society and a culture to thrive and prosper when half of the community you're talking about is not doing well at all.
Yeah, I mean, despite the title of the book, I personally am not actually that ideological. I felt like I started with a personal story of this couple that I was following that I tell in the introduction. And as you mentioned, I was running a women's site at the time, and all these statistics were coming at me. This was 2009 when women became more than half of the workforce for the first time in history. Women were getting more PhDs. You know, they were rising up in the managerial chain, becoming doctors, lawyers. So I would see all these statistics piecemeal, and I started to connect them to the human stories. And as I said, I mean, some were exhilarating. I mean, the idea of opening opportunities for women, women thriving in ways that they never had before. For the college educated, the story is not perfect, but there's a lot more good news in it. There are happier marriages, and I describe why that is. But for people without a college degree, it's something I call ambiguous independence. That is, you know, women are doing so much more alone. On the other hand, they are empowered in some way.
What makes you think that this isn't a blip, that when the economy recovers, you know, it might be after, similar to after World War II, where the women get kicked back out of the jobs and back into the kitchen? What makes you think that that's not going to happen in a rewrite version?
I can't be for sure, because one thing I resist is this notion that we all have innate traits which make us absolutely destined to be one way or the other. I mean, it's funny you should mention World War II. I've been thinking a lot about that. And the idea that after World War II, men exhibited some of the traits that I'm seeing in women today. Hustle, flexibility. They were getting a lot of degrees because that's the time the GI Bill was passed. You know, taking over farms, moving into offices. You know, sort of how I describe women behaving now, which is almost like immigrants. And so it may be this thing where you have a perfect storm with women right now. What you have is, you know, a world in which you need college degrees and they're better at getting them. A world in which people, women still feel and are at some sense marginalized and discriminated against. And that's kind of giving them the fuel and the drive to feel like they have to work twice as hard. And thirdly, what you have is an economy which is starting to favor some of the things that women at this point do naturally, sort of a more cooperative understanding of what leadership is about, greater people skills, less brawn. And so you kind of have this perfect storm. Now, will it change? The reason I'm hesitant to say, you know, we see a lot of these trends taking root. On the other hand, technology changes everything so quickly. Like, you can look 10 years down the road and some technological innovation has made some profession completely obsolete. So, you know, in the way the world is changing, it's hard to completely predict. But it's still alarming. I mean, it's still amazing when you look at women setting down the roots and taking hold the way they are.
Now, when we talk about some of these qualities that help women thrive in the new economy, cooperation, open, good communication skills are another, empathy is another. I mean, are these just another version of the old gender stereotypes that we've been trotting out in one form or the other? Are these actually true about the sexes, that men are, do not have these qualities?
No, not exactly. I mean, this is why I include a chapter about violence. I'm walking a fine line here, but I think that a lot of it is socialized. So if you see, why are women thriving in this economy? Well, you know, women are getting greater degrees, and we all think of women as sort of good students. You know, they sit still, they focus, they're very organized. Then that tends to open up jobs at the bottom of the economy, which also kind of perpetuate gender stereotypes, because these are things that women used to do for free. If you look at the jobs that are opening up there, child care, elder care, health fields, you know, like women's work, as we have always called it, you know. So in some sense, it's true, we are taking advantage of what we think of as traditionally feminine qualities. On the other hand, I include a chapter on violence, which is kind of my chapter that confuses people, largely because I didn't want to end the story there, that, you know, look at these lovely feminine qualities. Aren't they wonderful right now? Women are also becoming more dominant, aggressive, and expressing violence in the public sphere in ways that they never have before. So in a sense, what you see them is exhibiting feminine traits and taking on what we've thought of as traditionally masculine traits, basically owning both those territories, which has not been true for men over the century. When I talk about adaptability, I'm not really talking about personalities. I'm talking about historical trends. So men, for example, don't tend to change very much how they behave in the public sphere. They tend to shy away from professions that are considered traditionally feminine. You know, as soon as women take over a profession, men run away from it, which is the opposite of what women do. And so I do think women are, in a sense, doing both.
Yeah, I guess that's why the story is so complex. You talk about violence. you know, it's good that women might be as ambitious as men, but not as good, you know, that they might be violent and aggressive, and that there's a rise in women murderers as well.
Exactly. I mean, that's the complicated, tricky picture here. I thought it was important to include that chapter for a couple of reasons. One is that I think in our minds, we kind of link the testosterone fuel aggression of men with the reason that they are permanently dominant. We kind of have this evolutionary story in our subconscious, whether we're, you know, aware of it or not. And so I wanted to show people that this story is not as tidy as we think it is, that actually the reason that women don't express aggression in the public sphere is not because they don't feel it, but because they've been socialized not to express it. And so as those barriers break down, what you see is women expressing a lot more aggression, higher arrest rates, different kinds of aggression, even public brawls, even the kinds of stuff we see on reality TV are things that were unthinkable a while ago. Think of something like the Hunger Games. I mean, you know, something in the popular imagination, probably the most popular heroine of our age. I mean, she's part of the old warrior culture. She's aggressive. She's the protector. She's the provider. She's in some sense difficult to like. You know, it takes a long time to realize where her nobility lies. And that's a trait of men, whereas PETA in The Hunger Games, you know, her male counterpart, exhibits traditionally feminine traits. He's more cooperative. He knows how to win over a crowd. He knows how to make peace. And so I think that we're playing around with these tropes in very different ways than we ever have before.
And it's interesting to play around with them that way. You talk about Katniss Everdeen. She's a really dynamic heroine. We're crossing sort of genres about what makes a good hero in a movie. And I wonder if any of this could have anything to do with sort of just the zeitgeist and the fashion that women are sort of maybe cool right now. We saw the fall of the banking industry brought about largely by men. You know, you look at Iceland, where the new head of state talked about putting an end to the age of testosterone. Maybe it's just women's time.
That's what it looks like to me. It's interesting you mentioned the Wall Street crash. I think that had a big impact in our thinking about leadership, which was already changing. So if you read models of leadership now, they don't sound like they used to in the 60s and 70s. So there's not a sense anymore that you have to be top down and, you know, really aggressive and issue orders. What you have now is a sense that a leader has to be what they call transformational. In other words, a leader has to kind of inspire people and get people working together and motivate them. And so you see leadership starting to incorporate basically emotional intelligence, the idea of reading people. And then the Wall Street crash comes, and suddenly people really start to scrutinize the things that we thought we liked. So, you know, we thought it was really good to be aggressive and make lots of trades. But then when researchers started to look at the number of trades per week that a single man made versus the number of trades per week that a single woman makes, and the man makes vastly more trades, and it turns out to be much worse for the bottom line. And suddenly you have articles that say things like, you know, is testosterone the new, you know, did testosterone bring down the economy? You know, things like this. So I'm not saying that testosterone brought down the economy. I'm just pointing out what you say. You know, the culture of science has changed. We're starting to scrutinize man hormones the way we used to scrutinize female hormones. And so the culture is shifting towards thinking, oh, maybe these feminine traits like caution that we used to think of as detriments are actually advantages in leadership.
Right. And you sort of see that being played out the world over, where people are sort of playing with these gender expectations. I'm thinking about Japan. You talk about a culture of herbivores, which refers to young men, I guess, who don't want to get married, don't want to have sex, and they're just engaging in things like gardening and tea parties.
Yes, in a very aggressive kind of I will definitely not be my father way. Again, Japan and Korea are going through similar things sort of a decade apart. And because I haven't spent a huge amount of time in Asia, I'm really just, you know, I will admit my analysis is like, you know, not as deep as someone who's a true Asia expert. But when I do look at Korea and Japan, the thing that amazed me the most is, as I said, this idea that it's like men and women are suddenly looking at each other and deciding that they're strangers to each other. You know, that you've got these women who are super ambitious, who are suddenly winning all the top spots. And because Japan and Korea don't have a one-child policy like China, you don't get these skewed ratios the way you do in China. And, you know, they're deciding that, you know, I don't want to be the woman that Korea and Japan has always deemed a woman should be. That just doesn't fit with how I've been educated, my early life in the workforce. You know, this all doesn't make sense to me. So you see a lot of pressure, men essentially marrying women from other countries like the Philippines, you know, sort of people importing brides who more fit their traditional notion of what a bride should be. And you see, you know, young people getting married at older and older ages.
How does this make you feel as you are researching this? You said you're a feminist, as am I. I also have a son, and I have to admit, reading this made me a little worried.
Yeah, I mean, I have two sons and a daughter myself, and so I try and look on the bright side. I mean, some of it makes me think really hard about certain social policies, both for men and for women. You know, when you take the non-college educated and the drastically declining marriage rates, I think a lot about how we can help these families that are thinly stitched together. You know, how we can help these families who are maybe not married but still exist as a supportive unit, because American social policy really thinks mostly about married families. You know, so I think about that kind of thing. For women, I write in the book about the problems at the top and how the workforce really, despite the rise of women, still behaves like it's 1962 America. You know, we don't have paid maternity leave. We don't have childcare. I mean, all the things that we often talk about are still true and haven't changed. And so I wish the support structure was there to make this obvious economic reality a little easier. But the bright side here is, you know, if I'm thinking about my son, and I dedicate this book to my son, who's very offended by the title, just something I've talked about. I dedicate the book to him because I feel like if he grows up, and he's 9 now, so he's far from this, but if he grows up and he's engaged or has a girlfriend who makes more money than he does, which is a common situation for young people these days, and, you know, they get married and then he decides that he wants to work 4 days a week and on the fifth day, you know, do his hobby or pick up the kids from school just because he's that kind of guy. Like, no one should think twice about that. That shouldn't even be something that's remarked upon. And I think that would be better. You know, I think if we open up the space and use our imagination and essentially expect more of people and let them breathe a little bit in the roles that we've expected them to play, I think that would be better for him and not worse. So some of it is definitely hopeful.
Well, our guest this hour is Hannah Rosen. She's a contributing editor at The Atlantic and the co-editor of Double X. Her latest book is called The End of Men and the Rise of Women. And we want to know what you think about this. What do you think about a new world where women take the lead and men are maybe on the sidelines? And why do you think it is that men are having trouble adapting to the new economy right now? Do you expect this to be a permanent change or something that's just a passing fad? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also shoot us an email to talk@wpr.org or chime in on our Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, join us for Talk of the Nation Science Friday. You can join Ira Flato for a look at how wildfires and an invasive weed are changing the landscape of the American West, plus a look at the use and misuse of DNA evidence in solving crimes. I'm Veronica Rickert with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this hour, we're talking with Hannah Rosen, who is a contributing editor at The Atlantic. And we're talking about her new book called The End of Men and the Rise of Women. And wondering what you think about that, about a new world, maybe where women are in the leadership roles, in the work, in the family, in culture at large, and men are having trouble adapting, and they're sort of marginalized, which is what we're seeing at the moment, according to our guest. And we'll go ahead and take our first phone call now. We've got Joe joining us from Wausau. Hi, Joe.
Hey, I've talked about this issue a lot with a friend of mine. She was the leader of the Women's Resource Center in UW Stevens Point. And I'm 26 years old and obviously a guy. And I think I kind of grew up right at the apex of the women's right movements, where women are finally starting to realize their full potential. And I think the main problem here is women have gone through 50 years of equalizing with men, and men haven't even started. So we're going through this identity crisis. And I think this really, really comes to a point when you look at things like clothes. 80 years ago, it would be unheard of for a woman to wear pants. And now women can wear whatever they want. And when you think about men, we are still very extremely socialized into an extremely limited gender role. And it makes it very, very difficult for us to adapt in this incredibly increasing pace of life, how things just keep changing. And as women are encouraged to explore, men are still encouraged to fit their traditional roles. So someone like me who wants to maybe raise a family instead of win the bread, it makes it difficult for me. And something I think we can do about this is, instead of thinking about women's rights, it's thinking about gender equality.
Mm-hmm.
There's maternity leave everywhere, but the idea of paternity leave is scoffed at. And for the families where the woman is making the bread, winning the bread, paternity leave could really equalize the whole playing field and give both genders the freedom, and even give women the freedom to take on their career, as the man would stay home and take care of the domestic things.
That's a great point, Sergio. I like how you brought up thinking about gender equality. That seems like maybe that's at the core of what needs to happen. What do you think, Hannah Rosen?
I love that guy. I completely 100% agree with the caller. This is one of the many reasons I love Wisconsin. It's, I think he's absolutely right. I mean, we don't, you know, I have been forced to think a lot about how far I want to push this, you know, because we've had periods of gender experimentation in America. Why can't William have a doll, you know, and sort of people laugh at that sort of thing. But why? I mean, why is it we definitely need a space for men who would like to be more domestic? I mean, when I looked at sitcoms, for example, 50 years of sitcoms, anytime a man enters the domestic sphere, he's like a bumbling idiot, or he drops everything, or he gives his children bad advice. It's like we're afraid to let that happen for some reason. And it's not like I think in 100 years, you know, half of men are going to be stay-at-home dads. I do not think that. But I do think there's a greater percentage of men who would like to play a larger domestic role but feel that they can't because of social pressures, just as I feel there's a greater percentage of women who would like to, you know, fully express their ambition, but there's also social sanction against that. Because there's a lot of pressure on women to be a certain way. So I completely agree with him. It's like less maternity leave than maternity, paternity leave, or child care, these things that more acknowledge that children are raised by two parents.
So, Hannah, when we talk about gender equality, you mentioned domestic arrangements, dads staying at home with the kids, raising the family. What other areas do you look at and say, this is an area where we really need, you know, men to catch up and evolve and change?
So child care is one thing. Another is in choice of profession. I mean, you've seen over the course of the century men really running away from any profession that has a female taint. So secretaries used to be a male profession. Almost as soon as women started going to secretarial school after the turn of the century, men flee that profession. That happens with teachers as well. And teachers is one I like to emphasize. I know this isn't a great time to be a teacher because there's been a lot of state budget cuts. But, you know, recession aside, I think we could solve a lot of problems if more men would become teachers. Why? Because boys are having trouble in school. You know, there's a way in which we feel that girls are the gold standard in school, in which boys feel that schools are working against them. A lot of parents complain about this. If there were more boy teachers, male teachers, we could really make headway with that problem. And so that's, you know, that's another area in the workforce. There are towns that I write about in the book where couples I write about, you know, have a very traditional notion of manhood. And again, I'm not going to beat them over the head with this. Like, there's only so far you can push people. And I think we also have to do a lot with our recovery from the manufacturing age and giving people an exit which doesn't feel like you're forcing them to be feminized. But I look at these towns and I look 20, 30 years down the road and I think, you know what? The only jobs that are going to be available in these towns in the next generation are going to be government jobs, a lot of teaching jobs, and healthcare jobs. And if the men absolutely refuse to do those jobs, they're really going to be in trouble. So that's another place where I wish we would ease off on the men.
It's interesting to hear you talk about, you know, teachers. I think about remarks that teachers I know have made about how when there is a man teacher in the school, sometimes he's treated kind of like a celebrity or a rock star because there are so few of them. You think that might be encouragement?
Yes, we have that in my son's school right now. There's one guy teacher in his grade, and it's true. It's like there's a sort of mystical aura around him because, you know, and everyone thinks, is he tough? Is he, you know, a genius? There is a little bit of that, especially in elementary school where my kids are because of what you described. There's such a rarity.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Joe. Appreciate it. And we go next to Joel in Black Creek. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
It's Friday, so I'm doing well. Hey, so, you know, the first comment I want to make is I think, you know, gender roles are just absolutely stifling, right? I mean, they're kind of an inhumane thing to do to people to create this set of expectations that maybe don't fit to, you know, any one person as a generalization. So, you know, and then to hold people to it, you know, I think it stifles creativity and individuality. So I think if we could just get rid of that and let people be people, that would be great. So, but maybe that's too, you know, too much to ask. But anyway, so I want to say that I think the reason why guys shy away from women's, quote unquote, women's careers or women's work is because traditionally it paid less. And so, and guys were breadwinners, usually primarily breadwinners, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. So if they're going to support a family, you know, they need to make the most money possible. Then the next thing I want to say is I think one of the reasons why there are more women in the workforce these days, I mean, yes, you know, women's, you know, women's lib and that sort of thing, you know, women want to get out in the workforce and that's good, but more and more, I think families are forced to do it because jobs are paying less and less and less. I mean, you look at the median wage since 1980, it's been flat or has fallen. So in order for people to make ends meet, I mean, in my family, we'd love it if either my wife or I could stay home and take care of the kids, but we can't afford it, you know?
Yeah.
And then I want to mention one more thing. My wife, the reason why I started off with gender roles is because my wife gets on me sometimes because I don't act like a man enough, you know? And meaning like I'm not out there trying to get the highest paying job, the spending 60 hours a week working. I'm not motivated that way. My dad was never home. He was that kind of guy. And I thought, you know, when I had kids, I wanted to be around and spend some time with them. And there's a lot of sacrifices that need to be made if you want to, you know, become president.
Well, Joel, lots of great stuff to chew on there. Thank you so much for calling.
Yep.
And Hannah, one thing that struck me was Joel talking about the wage gap, that men don't want to do these jobs because they don't pay enough, and women do still earn less than men. And what do you make of all that?
That's true. And can I just say what a wonderful, thoughtful set of callers you have on your show?
You may.
They raised so many excellent points. I mean, there were 12 things I could have addressed in that last caller's question. It is true that women don't make as much as men. It's kind of a vicious cycle with these professions, or at least it used to be, where the professions that are highly valued, it used to be that as soon as women entered them, the value of the profession would drop. That's happening less and less these days. The profession that I focus on, and it's actually at the University of Wisconsin Pharmacy School that I write about in my chapter on pharmacy, is pharmaceuticals, which has lately become female-dominated. And I write about how that dynamic is changing now. And so the women's entry does not necessarily devalue a profession. But the wage gap is still true and I think speaks to deeper structural problems. On the one hand, I think it's fueling women to kind of work hard, work twice as hard. You know, as I said, their feeling of marginalization, the feeling that the workplace doesn't treat them fairly, is part of what's driving them forward these days. On the other hand, we haven't addressed the deeper structural issues. I'm actually less interested in the purely discriminatory aspect of the wage gap, although I am interested in that, than I am in the fact that women, you know, carry a greater burden of the childcare still, feel that they have to, end up working fewer hours generally, and end up having kind of more spotty careers, even though they're set up for very ambitious careers, largely because we just haven't solved that puzzle yet of, you know, how can we make this all fit together? As your last caller said, a lot of times the things that I'm describing are not happening because of a great feminist march in the streets. They're happening because families need the money. So a lot of women that I describe explicitly say, I do not call myself a feminist. I would not be working. I don't want to work, you know, but I have to work. So women find themselves in these positions and they're working because they have to. Nonetheless, that does cause shifts in the family dynamic. Also, as your last caller said, and this was the most profound thing I think he said, which is something that's come home to me as I've been talking about this book, is that we women put pressure on men to be a certain way. And I'm not actually sure whether that's by a lot. I'm not sure how to get around that. I'm not sure if that's where really the rubber hits the road. In other words, where it's not so much about men, you know, being lazy or inflexible or whatever we might say about men. It's that women demand that men be a certain way, and that it's going to be hard to get around that. I think that's the really difficult question that I'm struggling with.
So you think that's true, that women do expect a certain sort of manliness from men?
I'm thinking about it. I mean, when, you know, it's something that's come up so much as I've been talking about this, where people have said, you know, well, okay, take your own life. You know, my husband is the editor-in-chief in Slate. He's been working as long as we've been together. What if your husband woke up one morning and said, honey, I'm done. I'm tired of working. I want to be a stay-at-home dad. Like, how would that strike me at a deep visceral level? You know, this is a question someone asked me. What would I think about this? Would I, you know, be okay with it? Would I be happy to take the reins? Would I still be attracted to him? Would I think there was something wrong with him, you know? And I've had to really think about that. What would I think if that happened? I actually don't have an answer, but it is, I think, an excellent question.
Are those questions about gender, though, or are those questions about partnership?
Maybe there are questions about partnership. I mean, in situations where I've seen this work out well that I've described in the book, the partners sort of work this out beforehand, you know, so it's a slow organic process whereby, you know, the couple's together when they're younger, and then it's clear that the wife is really ambitious, say, and wants to be a doctor in a particular couple that I profile, whereas the husband, you know, is a more creative sort and likes to do freelance writing and is more domestic naturally, and so they kind of fall into those roles naturally. And sure, there are tiny resentments, as there are in any marriage, you know, like, why am I carrying more of the financial load? Am I really satisfied at home? I mean, the same kinds of things you would hear if the genders were in the traditional setup. But you know, all marriages have their problems, so it rises organically. So yeah. Maybe, you know, that's where it seems to work out well, rather than kind of the abrupt shift that I've seen happen in some marriages, where I think it's more difficult to incorporate the new roles.
Let's go back to the phone now. We've got Tom joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hey, go
Thanks
ahead.
My question or comment revolves around the reality that we still, as a society, identify attributes and virtues as female, as women's or men's, rather than feminine and masculine. All of us have masculine, feminine traits. In my faith, the Baha'i faith, we were told back in the 18th century that the feminine attributes are moving into ascendancy, and that it was necessary for men to develop their feminine attributes in order to bring about the social goals of human evolution, which is global unity. For nations to get along, the attributes that are needed are traditionally identified as feminine. But here, in our country, we identify them as female. And that's profoundly limiting both to women and to men.
So from that perspective, Tom, I mean, do you see what's happening now as an opportunity for men to grow and grow into maybe what you might consider some of these feminine qualities?
Well, going back to your comments, I think that there's an organic process in play that men who are trying to resist the spiritual necessity of the age are going through stress. And those that embrace these changes are succeeding. If you take the CEO of today and compare him with one 100 years ago, the attributes are much more feminine that he is using than what were being used 100 years ago.
Interesting perspective there from Tom. What do you think about that, Hannah?
I love that corrective, actually, that we shouldn't describe these traits as female and male, but feminine and masculine. It's a subtle difference, but I think it's a really important difference, because it means that, you know, a man can take on what we consider traditionally feminine traits. It allows you both to kind of grasp in your head the idea that we there are traditionally feminine traits, but that they're not limited just to women. I mean, it's a complicated idea, but I think it does work in this moment because, like I said, there, you know, maybe we can say that the economy is rather than saying the economy is favoring women or female traits, if you say the economy is favoring traditionally feminine traits and that leadership is moving in a traditionally feminine direction, you're not excluding men from embracing those things. You're just saying they, you know, historically or traditionally feminine, but men can embrace them almost as easily as women, just as women can embrace more traditionally masculine traits.
Well, thank you so much, Tom, for that call. And I want to read an email now because we haven't heard from any women. And this is from a woman and a wife who says, my husband has not had steady income since 2009. I was a stay-at-home mother who raised six children. When my husband was out golfing with his phone shut off and we were in foreclosure and so forth, I went out and started working. I currently supply our health insurance through my employer. Now my husband is self-employed from the home, but he doesn't take care of chores as I did when I was in the home. I feel a total role reversal, and I think it's making me resentful. Are you hearing this from women right now?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the things I did in the book was survey couples where the wife was the breadwinner, similar to the woman who just wrote this email. And some, you know, 8,000 people answered the survey and wrote me emails much like this woman's email. And I began to interview people. And one amazing thing that I found, or alarming thing, I would say, is that even in couples where the woman was carrying the full load, making, you know, even in the multimillionaire corporate real estate lawyer women that I interviewed, almost never does the woman give up nor the man completely take over the domestic sphere. It just doesn't happen that way. So that women are working much more hours, you know, supporting families in greater numbers, but the men are not, you know, being completely domesticated. Now, I'm not blaming the men. In a lot of cases, you can look and say women are having a hard time letting go of the domestic sphere. I write a story in the book about myself watching my husband take my kids on vacation because I had to finish a chapter of the book, which was due, and all through my head was running the script about everything he was doing wrong. I mean, think about what a great favor. We have three children. He's taking them on vacation with my in-laws without me. And all I'm thinking is, you know, he's packing the wrong boots. He's bringing the wrong gloves. He brought the wrong books, you know. So I I'm a person living this life, so I don't know who to blame in that situation. You know, is that women have a hard time letting go of these fears, and they're so connected to kind of domesticity and children, either out of habit or out of, you know, internal wiring. I don't know which, but they're so connected, it's hard for them to let go. Or is it that men just, you know, are able to block out a lot of stimulus? You know, I don't think that my husband, if I think about it in retrospect, who cares that he brought the wrong gloves or the wrong hat or the wrong books? They had a great time, you know? They borrowed some gloves from the neighbors and had a snowball fight. It didn't matter at all. But, you know, this is just the way that we have, you know, we've been. So I do profile a couple in which the people have I thought it was a positive image, but people have written me about this couple that I have in the book and said, why isn't the husband doing more? You know, he's not cleaning up, like he's not cleaning the house, he's not making dinner. And I like thought he was a charming guy, but nobody else reading about the couple thought that. So
it sounds like growing pains for everyone. I mean, who knows what our attitudes might be 10 years from now, 5 years from now. Things could look completely different as we kind of go through this change.
Yeah. And it's funny that we focus on housework because a lot of feminist liberation in the late 60s and 70s was about women and housework. You know, it was about liberating women from housework. I just thought of this now, actually. And yet when we look at what men are doing wrong, we often focus on the things they're not doing in the house, you know. And so it is a funny moment that way.
Well, housework is. I remember reading a Times story about how housework was one of the primary reasons people got divorced. Yeah. I mean, along with money and religious beliefs, but housework was in there. It's kind of a big battlefield.
Well, how about this one? Can I just add one thing here?
Yeah.
When I wrote my survey, I asked a series of questions just to gauge, you know, who does more housework? Are you happy? You know, are you likely to get divorced? Just the whole range of questions about a marriage. And somebody wrote to me and said, why do you define housework when I put in parentheses to define housework, you know, laundry, cleaning, cooking? And they said, you know, when you define housework that way, you're favoring women inherently. Why don't you define housework as plumbing, you know, fixing the roof.
Mowing the lawn, taking out
mowing
the trash.
Mowing the lawn, exactly, yeah. Taking out the trash, the stuff that men tend to do. If you expand your definition of housework, you might, you know, you might get a lot more men saying, I do my share of the housework. So I actually felt bad about
true.
That.
That's yeah. true. Interesting. Yeah. Well, we're talking this hour with Hannah Rosen. She is a contributing editor at The Atlantic, and we're talking about her new book called The End of Men and the Rise of Women, and talking about how women are rising to the top in our culture and globally as well, looking at areas like education, the workforce, and family dynamics. And men are having a harder time adapting, and they're retreating a bit to the sidelines. And it looks to be a major trend that could reshape our society and the world as we know it. And we're wondering what you think about that this hour. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also follow us on Twitter at VRueckert. That's VRueckert, where you can tweet us your thoughts or questions during the show. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rueckert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight at 8, the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio brings you coverage of the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association U.S. Senate debate. Democratic Congresswoman Tammy Baldwin and Republican former Governor Tommy Thompson square off in this hour-long special broadcast. Tune in tonight at 8 on this station or online at WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rueckert with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk with Hannah Rosen. She's the author of the new book called The End of Men and the Rise of Women, talking about how women are rising, both in the U.S. and globally in areas like education and family and the workforce. And we'll take our next call. We've got Diane on the line from Madison. Hi, Diane.
Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
As we're hearing that women are in ascendancy globally in terms of education and employment, I also note that you have a rise in fundamentalism, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish, an increase in membership in the Mormon Church. All of these are male-dominated institutions. And you look at the Taliban and the power that they have, Al-Qaeda, and you see them becoming more powerful in certain places in the world. Again, male dominance. So how do we talk about these two seemingly conflicting phenomena?
Right. Well, thank you, Diane. What do you think, Hannah?
That's a great point, and it almost always happens in such moments. Just last week, there was a story about how Iran banned women from taking a list of certain majors, like accounting, engineering. There was a whole long list of professional majors that women could no longer take. And, you know, to me, that was like a comical reaction to what was going on. Clearly, women were doing well in those majors and taking over as they are in so many other schools. And so the reaction to that was just to say, no, you can't do it, you know? So you often get responses like that. Somebody was telling me about how in Brooklyn, in very hipster Brooklyn, this came up at my synagogue on Yom Kippur. The rabbi was telling me a story about how there was a congregation among very young, kind of very trendy young people. There was a congregation in which the men and women sat separately, you know, returned to a kind of old orthodoxy. So I think it comes up in my interviews with people, you know, a much milder form of what you're describing, which is a nostalgia for an old order, you know, a wish for things to return to the way that they were, you know, for people to reestablish old ways. I hear this from people who are dating, you know, who will often say to me, you know, I go out with the, I think one of our callers already said this, you know, I go out with women and they want me to make all the decisions, even though they're, you know, professionals and doing really well. So I think it's a natural, you know, response and almost a frightened response to this kind of situation. That's how I think of the contraception debate that came up in the war on women in this election. The idea that we would reopen a debate on contraception is preposterous given the role that women play, you know, just out of necessity in supporting their families. So there's no chance that, you know, we're going to go back to a world in which contraception is not widely available. And so, you know, you do feel like there are these reactionary moments that go almost always along with these moments of great upheaval and change.
So, but what about those movements? Do they pack any cultural punch, or are they just sort of a last gasp as you see it?
Well, I can't speak for the Taliban. You know, I don't know. Obviously, that's an extremely powerful movement that has a lot of support and, you know, has and staying power in the Middle East. So I can't say that the Taliban is the last gasp. But I can say that, you know, we think of the Middle East as off the map on women's rights. And I used to say that in my public appearances until people started writing me and saying, you know, don't write us off. You'd be amazed what's going on in the Middle East. Why do you think you see so many pictures of women in those Arab Spring revolts? It's because, you know, lots of Arab countries, like the rest of the world, have established all these new universities. And guess who's going to the universities? And guess who's earning all the degrees? And so you suddenly have all these extremely well-educated women with a lot of knowledge and no place to put it. And so you are creating some kind of countervailing pressure, even in these societies which are extremely repressive. So I'm not sure where it's all going to land, but I don't think the picture is the same as it was 100 years ago.
Well, since we're talking about the Middle East, something that came to mind as I was reading your book was that as some of these cities and countries fell in these recent U.S. wars with the Middle East, there was a lot of concern about young men being displaced and not having a place to show up to work, and that they would form, I guess, sort of de facto gangs and kind of raise a ruckus in these cities and these countries. Is that something we need to worry about in this country as we're talking about all of these men out of work who are feeling adrift and who don't really have that place that they used to have anymore?
I think we already see a little bit of this. One of the stories, the broad story on America between men and women and violence is that there's been a great decrease in crime, which nobody can really explain during this period of unemployment and recession. I don't really understand it myself. That includes a decrease in sexual violence and violence towards women and women's victimization. Some people explain it by saying, you know, women have more economic empowerment, so they're not trapped in abusive relationships as much as they used to be. I'm not sure about that, but there has been a decrease in crime. On the other hand, anecdotally, one hears about rageful reactions from men. And so one of the stories that I included does have, a man talking about that, about his rageful feelings and an incident when he actually did abuse his girlfriend, just because I felt like I'm picking that up a lot. So it needed to be included in the book in some way. But I don't know. I mean, it doesn't show up in the statistics yet, but it feels intuitively like that should happen.
Let's read an email now. This comes from Brandon, who says, as a stay-at-home dad, I feel that positive role models are needed for men to feel okay about not earning money and finding value in raising children. Could your guest recommend some current positive models that would be helpful to us, the men who are pioneering of a new kind of fatherhood?
He's in luck because I wrote a story about this recently for Slate, which is called The Evolution of the Adultish Dad. And this is, I spoke about this earlier, how looking over sitcom history, I realized that, you know, we had so powerfully portrayed a man in the domestic sphere as a bumbling idiot until very recently, so that we have only now just started to get away from that trope. And I do think pop culture is really important, because I think part of what happens for women is every time they do something different in the public sphere, there's a TV show to validate it and put it in the mainstream, you know, whether it's, you know, Mary Tyler Moore or Murphy Brown or Sex and the City. It's like suddenly it becomes completely accepted because there's a hit TV show about it. And men haven't had that validation in the pop culture. There's a show called Up All Night, which stars a stay-at-home dad. And initially, they had him fill that same bumbling stereotype. I think in the first episodes, he was watching a hockey game, you know, as the baby's kind of tipping over on the couch, you know, the usual scene in such a show. And as the show's evolved, they've really started to relax into the character. And he is now not only extremely competent, but also remained sexy, which I think is really important, you know, or desirable to his wife. So he's not emasculated at all. And there's a new NBC show about guys and babies, guys raising babies. And then the movie What to Expect When You're Expecting had Chris Rock as head of this dudes group in which they would walk around in the park, and they were pretty cool, and you kind of wanted to hang out with them. So I think we are starting to sneak in more characters of stay-at-home dads who are competent and cool. And that's what you need right now.
That's great. I didn't know about those examples.
Yeah.
So the Homer Simpsons are kind of fading away too, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, you just see people playing with it. They think it's not all that interesting. When I wrote this, this book is based on a story I wrote in The Atlantic in 2010 with the same title, The End of Men. And when I wrote that story, somebody sent me an article in The Wall Street Journal saying that something like 30 producers had brought that story into pitch meetings in order to write new sitcoms. And I think, you know, no credit to me. I didn't have anything to do with it. I'd never even been to a pitch meeting in my whole life. But I think that people, it's interesting to think about dynamics changing, you know, just for narrative reasons, just to not repeat the same old sitcom jokes that you've had going for 50 years is interesting to people. There was also a great campaign that that caller would like to know about, where there was a Huggies commercial recently which showed a bunch of dads watching football as their baby's diapers grew increasingly soggy and they totally ignored them. And one stay-at-home dad started a campaign against Huggies, and he won that campaign. Basically, he got a bunch of stay-at-home dads to sign a petition, and Huggies took the ad off the air. Slate also wrote a story, which you can easily find by Googling it. But you know, it's that's the positive side of my book. Even though it's called The End of Men, you can think of it as, you know, the king is dead, long live the king, like the beginning of a new kind of man. And, you know, and you see the seeds of this beginning, both in my conclusion, where you see some of my characters grow and evolve, and some of the examples that I just mentioned of a new kind of man becoming more mainstream and accepted.
Well, I'm glad to hear the positive spin on this. I told our babysitter this morning about the book that I was going to be talking about, The End of Men, and he looked at me with a priceless expression and said, no, 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 tell her we're not done yet. So
that's great. My husband says it every morning. So, you know, he's got company.
So you think this is a positive thing that we could be looking at, too? I mean, is The End of Men meant to be a provocative title? But really, you think, you know, it's the kind of thing where it's a sign of danger and opportunity for all of us?
Absolutely. I just think it's an upheaval. Like, I don't have all that much value judgment about it because I'm not coming from a movement. So I, you know, I hesitate to make conclusions. But if you read the book, you'll see the stories. And some of them are fabulous. Some of them are heartbreaking. And, you know, the end is hopeful because we're all human beings and we like to have hopeful endings, myself included. And so when I got to the end of the storytelling, I thought, you know, what is the good that can come out of it? What are the hopeful directions that we can move in? After all, I have two sons. I don't want them to be over. I love them just as I love my husband, my father, my brother, and so and the many men I work with. And so, you know, one does try and see at least a light at the end of this tunnel.
Well, Hannah Rosen, thank you so much for talking this hour. Appreciate it. It's been good.
My pleasure.
Hannah Rosen, the author of the book The End of Men and the Rise of Women. She's also contributing editor at The Atlantic and co-editor of Double X. Thank you to Marika Suval for producing this hour, Rhonda Fanning for technical direction, Tim Allen for all his help setting up our ISD Unlines every week, and Rob Ferret for answering your phone calls. I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.